Coming up on this episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
There's the pre-symptomatic, and then there's the symptomatic. Yeah. I think that ketogenic diets make more sense in the symptomatic phase of the disease. It's been used to treat other brain diseases for a long, long time.
Hey everyone, it's Dr. Mark. People are always surprised when I tell them that even with a whole foods diet rich in plants, we can still be nutrient deficient. And addressing nutrient deficiencies is one of the lowest hanging fruits for optimizing our health and feeling better at any age. And that is why I'm a huge fan of AG1 from Athletic Greens. Since our soils are so damaged, the plants can't extract the nutrients because there's no living matter anymore. And we're up against issues like chronic stress and toxicity and sleep deprivation like never before. And our bodies need some extra help getting all the right information to work properly. Now that information comes in the form of vitamins and minerals and phytonutrients and good bacteria, all of which help our cells remember how to efficiently tackle their important jobs. So one of the things I use every day to support my diet is AG1 from Athletic Greens. With just one scoop of AG1, I get 75 high-quality vitamins, minerals, whole food source superfoods, probiotics, adaptogens, and more to support my entire body. Even with a really healthy diet, it's hard to hit the mark for all our nutrient needs. So I feel better knowing I have some extra help from AG1. Unlike other supplements and powders out there, AG1 is third-party tested and made without GMO, nasty chemicals, or artificial anything. It actually tastes great, kind of like a tropical green drink. I like it on its own mixed with water, but it also works really well in most smoothies. If you're curious about trying AG1 from Athletic Greens for yourself, right now they're offering my community 10 free travel packs with your first purchase. All you have to do is visit athleticgreens.com/Hyman. Again, that's athleticgreens.com/Hyman to take ownership over your health and pick up the ultimate daily nutritional insurance. Now, one of today's episode sponsors is ButcherBox. I love this company because they make eating high-quality meat and seafood accessible, affordable, and most importantly, really delicious. When I talk about high-quality animal protein, that means caring for the lives of the animals and the livelihoods of the farmers, reducing our impact on the environment and the climate, and feeding our bodies real food to promote optimal health. This is a huge caveat when it comes to eating meat and seafood. It has to be clean to be a good part of your diet. ButcherBox delivers 100% grass-fed, grass-finished beef and wild-caught salmon right to my door. They have different package and frequency options available, so you can order the best combination for you and your family without any penalty if you decide to cancel. And shipping is always free. The meat and seafood I get from ButcherBox is way better than what I find in the grocery store. For a quick weeknight meal this time of year, I love grilling up some of their wild-caught salmon and throwing it together with some arugula, red onion, lots of basil, balsamic vinegar, alongside some spaghetti squash. Yum. When you sign up to ButcherBox today, you'll get 2 pounds of wild-caught Alaskan salmon free in your first box by going to butcherbox.com/pharmacy. That's 2 pounds of sustainably caught wild Alaskan salmon free by going to butcherbox.com/pharmacy. That's F-A-R-M-A-C-Y. I hope you take advantage of this great offer. I know you're going to love ButcherBox as much as I do. Now let's get back to this week's episode of The Doctor's Pharmacy.
Hi, this is Lauren Feehan, one of the producers of The Doctor's Pharmacy podcast. Millions of Americans are affected by neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's, dementia, ALS, and more. The good news is that there are many simple steps we can take every single day to protect our brains and reduce the risk for or even reverse symptoms of cognitive decline. In today's episode, we feature 3 conversations from The Doctor's Pharmacy about why it is so important to take care of our brains when we are young and what to do if we are experiencing a brain condition. Dr. Hyman speaks with Dr. Marwan Sabah about the role of the APOE4 gene, with Dr. Richard Isaacson on lifestyle modifications that can prevent Alzheimer's and even reverse its decline, with Dr. Richard Isaacson on lifestyle modifications that can prevent and even reverse Alzheimer's, and with Dr. Jay Lombard about bacteria as the cause of neurodegenerative disease. Let's jump in.
By the time somebody walks into my office with memory loss, they've had disease changes in their brains for 2 decades. And we understand that biologically now. So you're seeing now a whole...
And you can see that on imaging scans.
We can see that on whole and imaging scans. So we're now seeing now a big push to move the calculus beyond the time of symptoms to much earlier and try to find people and identify people at risk. Along the way, but most of that research has been focused on drug interventions to prevent prevent, delay, or forestall the onset of symptoms. But along the way, of course, if I'm in my 70s and I know my disease started in my 50s or 40s, we can change beyond drugs. We can change to say lifestyle interventions have benefits. And there's now a whole new area of research. Exercise has really emerged as one of the areas that has grown with real biological evidence that it can prevent and improve brain function and brain health. And beyond that, we're seeing now people are looking at things like diet and supplements and other ways to manage the disease. And so I think this is an area that's just, you know, relatively new, but very exciting.
Yeah, I mean, there was a recent study called the Finger Study.
The Finger Study is one of the ones that we're going to talk about, which I talk about in the book.
Yeah, I know. And this study was done in Europe, and it was a very large study where they did an intervention with diet and exercise and stress
and addressing,
addressing cardiovascular risk factors. And tell us about the study. What did they find?
Yeah, so this study is done at the Karolinska Institute. The geriatrician, her name is Mia Kivipelto, a really, really sharp, very, very thoughtful physician scientist. And she said, we're going to create a multimodal intervention, including diet changes, managing health conditions, improving exercise, improving all their parameters. And one group was randomized to the intervention, and one group was randomized to just kind of passive intervention. And in an objective way, followed for over 2 years, with aggressive intervention, the treated group did much, much better over the 2 years. Not only did they not get a decline, they actually got better.
Wow.
And so, and these are people not young. They were sort of starting in their late 60s into their 70s. So these aren't people in the middle of life. They're kind of in the senior, running into the senior age. And they actually got better. And this has been published in the journal Lancet. So it's a very respected, you know, peer-reviewed scientific journal.
Well, this is really remarkable. I just want to pause here because what you just said is pretty radical. Now, like I said, we've spent billions of dollars on hundreds of studies and none of them show this. We can't slow or reverse it. Now you're saying just by eating better, exercising, optimizing your health, we literally can slow and even start to reverse the disease.
That is correct. In fact, the U.S. Has taking the Finger Study, and in 2019, 2020, there will be the U.S. version of it called the Pointer Study. Which will which is being rolled out in about six sites in the United States this year.
And the government has to pay for it because there's no drug involved.
The government, well, this is, to be very clear, the Pointer Study, so far as I know, is being funded by the Alzheimer's Association. Mm-hmm. I don't know if there will be federal dollars behind it. Mm-hmm. But the fundamental issue
But it's not a drug company.
It is not a drug company. But the fundamental issue is we want to answer an important question. Do these things objectively work? The signal, the way the evidence suggests, the answer is yes. Mm-hmm. And so having more evidence, because I have to tell you, you and I are both physicians. Part of our day job is taking care of people with disease.
Right.
So here we are saying, let's step back from that. Let's say, instead of treating disease, let's treat health.
Yeah.
And
did you take the course in medical school called Creating Health 101?
I did not.
No, I didn't either.
I did not take that course.
Yeah, and we didn't learn that.
We did not. But, you know, but the advantage of that is that it's not prescriptive. Then you can health recommendations that come up from consensus panels, and then it can have effect change at a larger level. This is actually easier to roll out if we can prove there's a signal than it is by just writing a prescription.
It's unbelievable. Yeah, I think, you know, what you said is really remarkable, that we need to focus on how do we create health rather than just treat disease or symptoms or pathways or some pathology.
That's correct.
Essentially what functional medicine is. It's asking the question, how do you create a healthy human being? What are the factors that knock you off that path? And what are the things that actually help create health? And those studies, the Finger Study and the Pointer Study, are looking at those factors. And there are more, right?
There are more. And I think that's the exciting thing is that I think, you know, I have to tell you, I've been involved in all these clinical trials. Every time there's a failure, it breaks everybody's heart.
Yeah.
There is no ego involved. It's not like, haha, I told you so. Because I will say to you, whether the drugs work or not, I'm going to clinic tomorrow or the next day, and I still got to look these people in the eye and say, you know, something good is coming. We just kind of hope that it's coming soon.
Yeah.
And so I say this to you because if I can see a path forward, whether it's a drug, a device, a lifestyle intervention, any way forward to help my patients either prevent, postpone, or delay.
Mm. Well, let's talk about the disease a little more in a medical way, because
sure.
the understanding was from my training was that the brain seemed to be disconnected from the rest of the body. We learned about this this barrier called the blood-brain barrier, where nothing except, you know, some nutrients got in.
And that's correct.
It was like this thing that disconnected our head from the rest of us.
Yes.
Turns out that our body is one system, and then our brains are connected to everything else that's happening in our gut microbiome, in infections, what we eat, our everything is actually influencing our brain function. So can you share a little bit about how this understanding has changed the way we think about the brain, and how some of these factors that are driving inflammation are actually causing this disease? Because it's a disease of brain inflammation.
It is. So the kind of the conventional wisdom that we're trying to look at is that inflammation is a response to an injury, or is it the injury itself? At the end of the day, you know, a lot of people think that there's an amyloid-triggered event, and then the inflammatory events occur because of the production of the amyloid.
And amyloid is sticky, gooey stuff that gums up your brain.
That is correct. And importantly, we used to think, as you said, there was, you know, north of the neck and south of the neck, right?
Yeah.
And that everything in the Alzheimer's was north of the neck and nothing south of the neck was related to it.
Yeah.
When in fact, now we know that things like gut microbiome can alter your immune system, and having a healthy microbiome can keep you healthy, and you can boost your innate immunity, which might reduce inflammation across the board, across the body, including the brain.
Yeah, and exercise helps reduce inflammation.
And BDNF. So the exercise, I have to tell you, I hated running.
Oh, no.
But I've taken up running because of BDNF.
So what is that?
That's brain-derived neurotrophic factor.
It's like Miracle-Gro for the brain,
It's Miracle-Gro for the brain. And the funny part about it is most neuroscientists are runners. They don't do anything but run. They have to have something to it. It's the fastest way to raise your BDNF levels.
Which is basically this growth factor that connects your brain cells together, so it causes neuroplasticity, which increases connections, and helps neurogenesis, which is the development of new brain cells.
That is correct.
So we never thought that was possible.
Never thought it was possible. We said once you're born with your neurons, you're going to get it. But we now know that the brain's making neurons throughout their life.
Yeah, I mean, I read a study where they studied terminal cancer patients, and they gave them this dye that only goes to dividing brain cells, and they found even at the point of death they're making new brain cells.
That's correct. We did when I was in Sun City, Arizona, at the Banner Sun Health Research Institute, we had a brain and body donation program, and we had scientists that could take brains of patients who had just expired and culture out, bring out stem cells that were still left alive in dead brain.
That's unbelievable.
So pretty cool stuff.
So these things like diet and exercise and optimizing your gut microbiome and stress reduction, they all, in a sense, work by regulating this inflammatory process.
That's correct. That is correct. That is, the inflammation, of course, is the unifying common pathway that we can manage. And, you know, the end of the day, that's what we want to do as well.
But studies taking Advil never really worked. They tried it, right?
Well, COX inhibitors have not worked. So then the questions are, scientifically, is it that pathway of inflammation? People are now looking at different pathways of inflammation, you know. Now they're looking at TNF-alpha, which is tumor necrosis alpha. They're looking at the fact that TNF-alpha might trigger enzymes related to Alzheimer's called BACE. So we think that there's links that inflammation is not just a broad category, but there's specific segments that seem to work and others that we've tried, like you said.
Yeah.
We tried anti-inflammatories for years to treat or prevent Alzheimer's. Didn't work worth a darn.
Right. Well, that sort of goes back to the thinking in functional medicine, which is what's causing it in the first place,
right?
So if you're standing on a tack, it takes a lot of aspirin to make it feel better.
Right.
Pull the tack out.
Right.
So it's not necessarily the best logic, but it's something that we have to sort of begin to wonder about. And I'm talking to one of your colleagues, Rudy Tanzi from Harvard, who said to me that they've done studies of patients who had brains full of this amyloid, but they had the gene somehow that didn't let them create inflammation, and they were cognitively intact. They didn't have dementia.
Right, and that's the amazing thing, is that you can go to your grave with a brain full of amyloid and not develop dementia. And we want to study those people because there's something that's protecting them against the development of symptoms. And of course, they may have just less inflammation, as you commented. Rudy Tanzi would be the guy to figure that out.
Yeah, and he talked about the microbiome of the brain. I don't think they're still trying to figure it out, but they're finding microbes in the brain.
Right.
We thought it was sterile up there, but turns out it may not be.
May not be.
Right.
And there's a new one that you probably have just hearing about. There's a company out of the Bay Area that found there's a oral bacteria called P. gingivalis, which creates a protein called gingipane, which may be a neurotoxin and trigger of neuroinflammation. And so they're looking at drugs to stop that.
Maybe brushing your teeth, flossing, getting them clean is a good idea.
It's good for the, not just good for the heart, it's good for the brain
as well.
That's
right. I mean, people don't probably know that, but one of the biggest triggers for heart disease is disease, right?
That's correct. And
so let's talk about the genetics here for a minute. So, most people think you get your genes, they're fixed. Your fate is sealed. There's nothing you can do.
Right.
It's not actually how genes work.
No.
You can modify these genes' expression, which ones get turned on and off and how they work. And I remember having this patient years ago who was a 90-year-old woman. She was a dentist. She had ApoE double four, meaning she had two of the worst genes you could have that are triggers or maybe predisposing to Alzheimer's. And she was 90 years old. She was still working and she was completely cognitively intact. And she was a health nut her whole life. She ate a perfect diet. She exercised. She never smoked. She never drank. She took her vitamins. I mean, it was remarkable
to
see that. Yeah.
That's impressive.
And this is what you talk about in this book with this woman, Jamie. She came to you because she had a family history of Alzheimer's.
Yeah.
And you checked her genes and she had that dreaded ApoE4 gene,
which
many people are afraid to test because they feel like it's just a, why bother?
So,
but you talk about why bother.
So right.
Tell us, why bother?
So I'll answer the why bother in a second, but Jamie is like your dentist patient. She's a 4-4. She found her story, of course, she found out her genetic risk by accident. Mm. Now, you and I know that if you are two copies of the APOE4 gene, your lifetime risk is 91% that you're going to develop it. It's almost a matter of when, not if.
Yeah.
And the problems with is that fortunately there's only 2% of the population that are double copy. 20% of the population is a single copy of the APOE4. But people are now finding out because there's commercial genetic testing by accident.
Like 23andMe.
23andMe, right? And then they go to Dr. Google. It's me and my friend Dr. Google.
Yeah.
And they're like, well, what does this mean? And they go and so the Jamies of the world are finding out day in and day out by accident. And they're trying to figure out what does this all mean.
Mm-hmm.
So the story is, on her half, is how she found out by accident and how it affected her. My half of the book is it a good idea to be tested? What are the consequences of being tested? What does it mean? Mm-hmm. And so that's what my half of the book about. It's a nice convergence of two storylines that help people to become informed because this is happening every day of the week.
It's happening anyway, but what your book, Fighting for My Life, suggests is that by knowing that, it can motivate people to take control of their life and their lifestyle and address the modifiable risk factors.
That is exactly right. And I want everybody who reads the book to be like your dentist patient, right?
Yeah. She was amazing.
I have to say to you, I had one other.
I'm not sure I would go to her at 90 years old to clean my teeth.
But sure, but she got to 90.
She was.
And right?
And working. Still working.
And I've seen only one other elderly person get to late 80s, 90s, a 4-4 who was unaffected. There's, in my career, I've always said that if you have that genetic profile, it's almost a foregone conclusion you're going to get Alzheimer's dementia eventually. But there was one exception to that. So we want everybody to be the exception, not the rule.
Now, one of the things we haven't really talked about yet is the role of sugar in the brain.
Yes.
And many people may remember Ronald Reagan's favorite food was jelly beans.
Yes.
And he got Alzheimer's. Now, maybe there's a correlation, but it turns out that diabetics have four times the risk of getting dementia.
That is correct.
And that we sometimes talk about Alzheimer's as type 3 diabetes.
Yes, this is Susan Delamonte from University of Rhode Island.
From Brown, yeah.
Yeah, Brown, yes.
And the truth is that we all have control over whether or not we get diabetes. This is almost 100% preventable and reversible disease by changing our diet.
Right. And do you know that insulin resistance, of course, is the hallmark of type 2 diabetes, and that we can see insulin resistance in the brain, and that's what the type 3 diabetes, even if you're not having insulin resistance in the rest of your body. And we think that, of course, and I strongly believe, like you, that that's a modifiable risk factor, that we can alter that. We can alter it, of course, the epigenome, which we're going to talk about. I hope we're going to talk about epigenetics. But the diet and the reducing the sugar intake and the diabetes risk is something we can alter and have a positive effect on.
So we all learned, I learned in medical school that your brain uses 25% of your glucose and it needs sugar to run.
Yes, it does.
True?
And the PET scans show that you need sugar to make your brain light up. So the rule of thumb on a PET scan is you want your south of the neck, you want to be dark.
Yeah.
North of the neck, you want to be bright on sugar PET.
Because if it's dark below, you got cancer.
If it's bright below, you got cancer. If it's dark, that's why you would. But in the brain, you want it to be nice and bright. You want that brain to light up because it consumes so much of the sugar metabolism is in the brain.
But you also say in your book, in patients who have Alzheimer's, that people are exploring the role of ketogenic diets, which means no sugar.
Correct.
And lots of fat, and the brain running on ketones instead
Correct.
Of glucose.
And the issue that people are trying to decide is, can you bypass insulin pathway mechanism? So if you're relying on insulin and pathways related to insulin to nourish your brain, and you have insulin resistance, either you can pharmacologically improve that, or you can dietarily improve that.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I remember this patient I had at the Ultra Wellness Center, my practice in Lenox, and she came in, she was about 78, and she started having what we call MCI, or mild cognitive impairment, and she had a whole bunch of things wrong with her. Thyroid was bad, she had gut issues, she had low vitamin B12, she had heavy metals and mercury, but she was able to fix a lot of these things and do a lot better for many years, and then she started to decline. And I'm like, well, let's try a ketogenic diet. And
right.
we got someone to work with her and cook for her. And it was like the lights went on again. It was pretty dramatic. And I think, you know, there's some preliminary studies that are showing that.
And you know, people have been looking at it. So the ketogenic diet all starts with the whole coconut oil conversation, which is coconut oil is controversial by itself. But the story behind ketogenic diets is that we do understand there's insulin resistance. The NIH actually funded a study looking at the ketogenic diets. Mm. So I think the science is there. It's just a matter of being able to prove it, and more importantly, to adhere to it.
Mm.
Ketogenic diets.
Not easy.
You know, it's not new to neurology. We've been using ketogenic diets to treat childhood epilepsy for 30 plus years.
Yeah.
So it's not new. It's new to Alzheimer's, but it's not new to brain disease. It's been used to treat other brain diseases for a long, long time. But, you know, fundamentally, it's really hard to diet to stick to.
Yeah. Well, we're finding, you know, more and more people are doing it.
It's
one of the hottest diet trends out there.
Right.
If you look at all the best-selling books, it's not mine. It's the keto books.
Right.
And we, you know, we're seeing just much more interest. And we're running keto programs at Cleveland Clinic. They're our most popular programs, which is pretty amazing. So people seem to be willing to try it.
I know you had Dan Perlmutter on a few weeks ago. And Dan and I, David Perlmutter. He and I have had an internet debate about this. And I will say to you that I think it's more nuanced.
Yeah.
I think that ketogenic diets that are insulin sparing make more sense in the symptomatic phase of the disease. And I have to tell you, I look at Alzheimer's disease in a dichotomous way. There's the pre-symptomatic, and then there's the symptomatic. Symptomatic disease means mild cognitive impairment and dementia. And I think there is some logic to a ketogenic diet. Yeah. In the dementia phase.
I agree. I think, you know, an ounce of prevention is worth a pound of cure, as Benjamin Franklin
Correct.
Said. And I think, you know, the ketogenic diet is a pound of cure.
It's a pound of cure. But I would not necessarily advocate for it in the mild, in the pre-symptomatic phase. I'm more advocating Mediterranean diet in the pre-symptomatic.
And that's the beauty of your book, is you talk about how to create resilience and
Correct.
Health so you don't need the pound of cure.
Correct.
Because the whole purpose of life isn't to be restricted. It's to actually be more resilient,
correct.
Healthy, so you actually are resistant to these diseases.
That's correct.
Right? So it's actually exactly the right idea.
There are so many things that we can do to put the ball back in our court, to write this script and tell our own story. You know, can you definitively 100% prevent Alzheimer's in every case? Well, no. I mean, there are certain pretty rare genetic causes where basically just about anything you're going to do, you're going to get Alzheimer's, and it's going to probably start early. And that's unfortunate, but that is an exceptionally rare number of cases. Most cases of Alzheimer's, you can do something about it. Based on the 2020 Lancet Commission, an amazing study based on 12 modifiable risk factors, the person makes brain healthy choices, prevent 4 out of every 10 cases of Alzheimer's disease.
Wow.
Like, we didn't learn that in med school. Medical students now aren't learning that in medical school. It takes 10, 15, 20 years for something to be learned in medical science to be translated into clinical practice. And I think it's important for this podcast and people like us to share this news, because there are so many things a person can do. So you asked me what can a person do. I want them to know there's so many things.
At least 12.
At least 12. Well, so, you know, in our study,
I think there's more, but there's at least 12.
At least 12. You know, in our study, we recommended on average 21 different things that a person can do. Oh, and those were individualized per person. In our whole universe of our study, we recommended almost 50 things that a person can do.
Mm. 50 things that influence the brain that you've identified.
Yep. And it's, you know, this isn't radical. This isn't rocket science. This isn't like, you know, I'm a simple man. I did not graduate first in my med school class. I did pretty good and I worked pretty hard, but you know, I try to just see things from the patient's perspective. And, there are so many things that are evidence-based and safe. The two categories I would start with, just to kind of set the stage, are pharmacologic and non-pharmacologic. And I want to get granular, because the word pharmacologic doesn't just mean drugs and prescription drugs. It also means
food is medicine?
Well, food is definitely medicine, although that got sidetracked to non-pharmacological. But I can
vitamins are medicine?
Vitamins.
I actually would challenge you, Richard, because I think that food is actually real medicine. The phytochemicals and compounds in food are biological response modifiers, or signal transduction changers, and they have a similar effects as drugs. In fact, many drugs come from the phytochemicals in plants. Right. So I would just kind of make us think about that a little bit.
Well, actually, so I'm glad you brought that up. I would say that traditionally speaking, and let's talk through this. This is a great opportunity. Yeah. So traditionally speaking, I've always framed it, and I'm open-minded, so this is great.
Yeah, yeah.
As pharmacologic,
I'm just teasing. Really.
Give it to, no, this is great. This is exactly why we're doing this. This is exactly a meeting of the mind. Gloves are off. Let's go. So, drugs, vitamins, supplements, and medical foods are the classic things that I personally have categorized in the pharmacologic session. And then in the non-pharm section, I've included diet, exercise, sleep, stress, a whole bunch of things, learning new things. But what you bring up is important. And you know, I have a colleague named Dr. Robert Krikorian, and he's an amazing guy. He's a neuropsychologist, and he's fought the good fight, you know, kind of like us. He's, I don't want to say he's had, yeah, in some ways had contrarian views, because he's tried to do randomized studies using nutrition. He's done studies on the ketogenic diet and Alzheimer's and Parkinson's, and he's done, you know, studies on blueberries and omega-3s. And what he's done is he's taken the food and he said, okay, it's not just about the blueberries. We did the study and wild blueberries are better. Well, why? Because of this thing. It's called anthocyanin. And then he gets down deep into it. So I completely agree that food is medicine, 100% agree. Yeah. I completely agree that the specific chemical nutrient compounds can be isolated, but I think it's too reductionist to just say, let's just put a pill of anthocyanins and prescribe that.
100%.
Because 100%. It's the milieu. It's right. It's like with caffeinated coffee is good for brain health. Well, is it the caffeine? Is it the coffee? Well, no, they think it's like some substance X during the brewing process, right? So you know, depending on which way you look at the science, I would prefer that food is medicine. It's just sometimes.
But I agree with you. I understand the bucket. So I'm just kind of playing with you. But
I love it.
But I think, I mean, when I put a patient, for example, on a ketogenic diet with Alzheimer's, and they wake up and their brain becomes alert and they remember their son and their daughter, and I'm like, well, how is that less a drug than some other drug that doesn't work that we're using, like Aricept, right?
Yeah,
it's impressive.
Yeah, no, I mean, I just feel like all of the different paths, like, you know, some people call like nutrition, not mainstream medicine. Like that to me as a Western doctor, that doesn't make any sense to me. Nutrition is like, I got very little nutrition education in medical school, and I think that's a terrible thing. I learned a ton, and I had to, my better half has a master's degree in nutrition from Columbia, and she's taught a lot, I think through
that
osmosis.
Explains everything.
There we go. It's always the better half, and she informs the less enlightened one. So, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is nutrition is the cornerstone of how we practice. Physical exercise and precision exercise, precision nutrition. These are all the things that are developing and really become the cornerstone of our care.
So you're talking about the 12, and then the 21, and then the 50, and maybe there's going to be 100. Tell us more about the granularity on that.
Sure.
You were using these, you know, and I just want to sort of frame it for people. You did a study that you published, I think in 2019, which surprised even you. We're using this approach looking at a personalized assessment of these biological factors that could be modified, mm-hmm. and then individualizing the treatment, that you not only slowed the decline, you not only stopped the decline, but you reversed the decline, which is something that has never really been seen except in a couple of trials like the finger trial. And I think there's a new one coming out, the pointer trial. So those are also lifestyle trials.
Yeah.
And so you really have sort of cracked the egg and published something that should have been on the front page of every major newspaper, the lead story in every evening news. And yet it was like crickets.
Yeah, well, I mean, we got the Wall Street Journal and CNN and some other, so I'm okay. I'm okay with that.
But for me, it was like, yeah. It should have been like the NIH should have gone, Richard, here's $10 billion to get going on this. Like, that's what it should have happened.
I have to be careful, but, you know, the NIH doesn't really fund what we do. And that's been, it's very hard. And listen, the NIH, I've engaged with the NIH over the last year or two, and there's definitely been more interest. But, you know, I talk about crickets. Years ago, a decade ago, when I started this whole thing, more 15 years ago, there was nothing. There was no funding for any of this. So, you know, what I would say is what our work shows is that when you individualize care and you give people a plan, and I know you've asked me at least three times now, what should people do? What I'm trying, why I'm delaying things is because it really truly needs to be individualized. And what we use is a term called the ABCs of Alzheimer's prevention management. Based on the data, we get data on A's, the B's, and the C's. A stands for anthropometrics. Anthropometrics is basically a fancy A word for body composition. What is your body fat? What is your waist circumference? What is your muscle mass? Depending on these factors, we're going to change the recommendations we give. The B stands for blood-based biomarkers. We're going to look at markers of lipids, cholesterol markers, also advanced markers that preventative cardiologists use, for example, that, you know, most neurologists honestly don't really pay attention to. We look at metabolic markers, insulin resistance. We look at inflammatory markers. We look at nutrition markers. You know, instead of saying, okay, well, go eat fish, it's good for you, we're going to look at the markers in the blood. We're then going to tell you, based on your blood and based on your genetics, how much fish you should be eating, what types of fish. So the take-home point is we're going to get granular with every patient. The other thing we do is in the blood-based biomarkers, we look at genetics. We look at the APOE4 variant. It's the most common risk gene. Doesn't mean you're going to get Alzheimer's if you have the variant, but it increases your risk. Well, if I know that you have the APOE4 variant, they check for this in 23andMe, and millions of people have gotten this checked, I'm going to personalize your care differently. If you have the variant, I'm going to give you plan A, B, and C. If you don't have the variant, I'm going to give you a little bit modified plan X, Y, and Z. If you have two copies of the variant, you have a different plan altogether. That's only 1% of the population. So, you know, the take home is we take all these markers, and then the C is cognitive function. And we understand a person's cognitive baseline. We look at memory function, language abilities, learning abilities, speed of processing, attention, and executive function, which is higher order processing. We take all of this and the patient's medical history. We learn about the patient. We learn everything we can about them, about their family, and then we personalize a plan. So those 21 different things are based on that person individually. And, you know, there's a lot of overlap. If you want me to say, okay, well, what are the core things? Well, exercise on a regular basis. Okay, well, exercise on a regular basis is good, but every person gets a different plan. If we're putting someone on a plan for body fat loss, we're going to give them a different plan. Steady state cardio, for example, some people would call that zone 2 training. Steady state cardio at 60 to 65% of your heart rate. There's different ways to do this through lactate testing, through a variety of things that we do, you know, more precisely in our clinic. But we put people on these steady state cardio plans fasted in the morning as long as they can tolerate it, because that way it jumpstarts body fat loss. If we have people that don't do any muscle strength training because they don't like it, we educate them to say, I don't like it either. I'm not, you know, Mr. Big Muscles over here, but I have to do strength training once or twice a week minimum, because if you don't have muscles, you can't boost metabolism. So we put people on these very specific plans. High intensity interval training. I really believe that high intensity interval training is almost necessary for people with at least one copy of the APOE4 variant. And this is what has been studied now in a couple of studies. And yes, we need more research, and the studies out of Norway were good, but we need to personalize an exercise plan. We need to personalize a nutrition plan. We need to personalize a vitamin and supplement plan. In some people, we do use drugs. It's, you know, drugs are actually not commonly used at all in our research, although we do use them on occasion. We'll use a variety of drugs, usually at much lower doses than maybe the regular community uses. But, you know, when it comes to, you know, management, equal opportunity. If there's data and it's relatively safe, you know, I'll entertain it. So we recommend, you know, cognitive activities that will have a spillover effect. Learning something new, learning how to play a musical instrument, learning a new language. These are things that may have a protective effect, build backup pathways. Believe it or not, even learning how to play a musical instrument in midlife has protective effects on cognitive outcomes in late life. And
there's hope for me yet.
There's hope for you yet. I got my bass guitar over there. I got blisters on my fingers.
I'm dying to learn to play the guitar. But my big problem is I don't know how to tune it, and I am so musically inept that I probably there are good apps and things to do it.
there's a website. It's called, you got a pen? It's called YouTube. YouTube, you may have heard of it.
I heard of it.
Almost as many people watch YouTube as listen to your podcast. So you can learn how to play guitar on YouTube. I think you can do it.
Okay, I'm going to try.
For sure.
That's my December.
Excellent. And January and February and March. So the take-home point is engage your brain. Treat your brain with respect. Love your brain. Make a plan for your brain. What does that mean? Make a plan for sleep. If you exercise and exercise and exercise, some people say colloquially that that loosens the amyloid, the bad protein that gets built up in the brain of a person with Alzheimer's. Mm. But if you're burning the candle at both ends and you're not sleeping during sleep, especially deep sleep, that's when a person has the trash come. The trash man comes, they pick up the garbage and they take it out and they take it to the trash heap. That is the restorative part of sleep. And if someone isn't sleeping, you know, at least seven and a half, 8 hours of sleep is usually the goal. As we get older, it's, you know, harder to sleep that much. But making a plan for sleep, prioritizing sleep. You know, we have people that track their sleep, that track their exercise. I'm wearing a wrist device here. I have nothing to disclose, but we've done, you know, several research using this, this device. I track people on my phone. I have my phone right here, and I can check how much exercise they've been doing, how their sleep, how much deep sleep. I can see their blood sugar control. I can see all these different things on my phone because my patients share their data with me. And when I talk about data sharing, it's not just about tracking sleep. It's not just about doing exercise. It's about tracking it, determining the response, talking to your physician about it. Granted, it's hard to find physicians that will take the time to talk to you about this kind of stuff. Tracking your blood sugar. There's, you know, at-home devices called continuous glucose monitors. In our program, we take a very, very deep dive, and we learn about all of these different metrics, and we refine or fine-tune the plan that we give them based on their real-time measurements. You know, I can keep going. There's stress modification. Yeah. You know, transcendental meditation. Bob Roth's taught me a ton about this. What about mindfulness-based stress reduction? You can take a course online. Mindfulness-based stress reduction has amazing outcomes when it comes to brain health. The list goes on and on. There's no one magic pill or one magic cure, but there are a variety of, I was going to say pharmacological and non-pharmacological, but you're reevaluating how I say this now. There are a variety of interventions that are evidence-based and safe that I think all of us need to learn about. You know, whether we talk about fasting, and I like the term time-restricted eating better, meaning not eating for 12, 14, 16 hours overnight, so at least 4 or 5 days a week. I use the term fasting for a more prolonged fast, you know, 24 hours or more, and that's a different discussion. There's the ketogenic diet. There's the Mediterranean-style diet. There's the MIND diet. There's components of each diet. Green leafy vegetables, wild salmon, grass-fed beef better than non-grass-fed beef because of the omega-3s. There's so many devil is in the details. Half a cup of blueberries and strawberries 2 to 3 times a week, you know, leads to better brain health outcomes and cognitive outcomes in the nurse's health study, you know, many years later on. There's dark cocoa powder. There's so many things that I can drop in as key things. But the take-home point is all of these things need to be individualized.
So let me ask you this, because, I mean, you know, first, I want to just kind of feedback, because what I'm listening to you thinking, you're a neurologist, but you're also an immunologist, a cardiologist, an endocrinologist, a gastroenterologist, a nutritionist. Yeah. I mean, right?
Yeah.
You're breaking down the paradigm of medicine, which is we should stay in our lane, focus on our organ, and leave the rest to everybody else.
Yeah.
And your insight here is that the body is a system, that everything's connected to everything.
Yeah.
But you can't just pick out one thing and work on that, like amyloid or tau or whatever, and get to the problem.
Yeah.
And it's sort of like trying to, bail the boat while there's holes in it. You got to fix the holes.
Yeah.
And essentially the holes that you're talking about are all these ways in which our brain gets injured by our lifestyle and by our environment. And you didn't mention toxins, but that also plays a large role. Mm-hmm. And so all of a sudden we have to sort of rethink our whole approach, which has really been a reductionist approach, single disease, single drug with a single outcome.
Yeah.
There was an article in JAMA a number of years ago called Shifting Thinking in Dementia. You probably saw it. Mm-hmm. And they said in that article that we combine categorical misclassification with etiologic imprecision. And in English, for those listening, that means we categorize dementia according to symptoms, not the causes. Mm-hmm. And we are not very focused on the etiology or the causes. We're focused on the symptoms. And we say, well, you can't remember this, and you fit this profile on your neurocognitive testing. You have Alzheimer's, or you have this kind of dementia, or Lewy body, or blah, blah, blah. And the reality is that you could have 10 people with Alzheimer's who need 10 different treatments. And that's exactly what you're talking about. That's heresy, Richard. Mm-hmm. That's heresy in medicine, honestly, because we really have a very, very restricted reductionist view of disease that doesn't let us actually even study these things. And I've literally had arguments with top leading researchers, like heads of research at major institutions, saying, these are all the factors that affect the brain. We want to study them together. So, oh, no, you have to study one thing at a time and then see how that works. And then one thing, so study exercise, and then study nutrition, and then study vitamin D, then study fish oil. Mm-hmm. I'm like, no, that's not how things actually work. it's like you have to use all the whole picture. The other thing I sort of wanted to sort of touch on was that you're sort of introducing a concept of the personalization, which again is very different in medicine. It's not one size fits all, and you're talking about very sophisticated personalization based on a whole set of biomarkers and tests and things that are easily accessible, but that aren't normally looked at and that aren't normally tested. You get your typical panel, you get your thyroid, your B12, you get your spinal fluid done, you get your MRI, and you go, okay, you got Alzheimer's. Like, it's sort of a little bit more complicated than that, but it's really a fairly narrow window of biomarkers and metrics. And there's bazillions of them. Mm-hmm. And I think we're just sort of touching the sort of tip of the iceberg on this. And I've seen in my patients, when you start to apply these concepts of personalized care around food, around exercise, around sleep, around stress, around supplements, around everything, that you really begin to see dramatic changes in brain function.
Yeah. I often joke that I'm like a one-third neurologist, but a preventative neurologist at that. I'm a one-third make-believe. I will, full disclosure, I'm not a preventive cardiologist, but I'm a make-believe preventative cardiologist. I'm a one-third primary care doctor and make-believe preventative endocrinologist. I don't even know any preventative endocrinologists. If you find one, introduce them to me. I was trained in an environment. I went to a 6-year medical program where I was in med school from day one, University of Missouri, Kansas City. Oh, I knew I wanted to be a doctor when I was 5, 17 years old, wearing my white coat. And I did so much internal medicine during med school. I had like an extra year of medicine because that's the way our training was. Yeah. And I don't know if it was that, or I'm not sure exactly what it was, but Alzheimer's disease is a medical disease.
Yeah.
Full stop. That's it. There's this thing called the skull, and it's a hard thing that protects you when you fall. But it's just like it's like when you have medical conditions, it can affect your kidneys. When you have medical conditions, it can affect your eyes. It can affect your heart. The same thing, it can affect your brain. And I couldn't agree with you more. People can take different roads to Alzheimer's. And you have to figure out what road they're on and get them the heck off that road. Women, for example, are unfortunately many times in the fast lane to Alzheimer's. Women, yeah. 2 out of every 3 brains affected by Alzheimer's are women's brains. And 5-10 years ago, I would say I didn't know why. And now I think I can answer that question. And it's related to the perimenopause transition. It's related to specific life factors. It's related to women being maybe a little bit more at risk if they have the APOE4 variant. So the take-home point here is if you understand a person's individual risk factors, whether it's biological sex, whether it's medical conditions, whether it's what's floating around in their blood, whether it's what is their cognitive function at baseline, you have to figure these things out. And then you have to target that plan and personalize that plan. And I mean, Alzheimer's disease and brain health needs to be treated in a medical way, because if it's not, if you're just targeting amyloid, you're missing the boat. You know, amyloid's a marker. And I think hopefully one day we're going to have, just like we treat diabetes with lifestyle interventions and exercise, and as well as certain targeted drugs that honestly, some of them actually do tend to work pretty well. I'm not the biggest fan of insulin. Like that doesn't, that's maybe band-aiding to me. That's probably too late. I mean, I'm not the best, whatever, but some of these new, new things that are pretty interesting. I won't get into specifics, but I hope that one day we treat Alzheimer's disease and cognitive decline like any other chronic disease of aging, where we hit things with a multimodal, evidence-based and safe approach that requires a medical intervention.
So essentially what you're saying, to paraphrase, is that Alzheimer's is not a brain disease.
Correct.
It's a systemic disease that affects the brain.
Yeah, I really believe that. I have to be careful saying that. Is this being recorded?
Yes. No. And it's going to be broadcast to billions of people around the world.
Oh, great. My field. I was just gaining some fans in my field, and now it's all last a decade of work.
No.
What are you going to do?
You are at the forefront of a paradigm shift that's happening throughout medicine, which is the breakdown of the old concepts of disease from simply this reductionist organ-based, symptom-based model to systems thinking and network medicine, and that's really all you're talking about.
There's very strong, compelling evidence at this point that bacteria are the cause of neurodegenerative diseases.
Rudy, we talked about Rudy Tanzi, who's a Harvard scientist, one of the discoverers of some of the presenilin genes, which are the genes that show that people are at risk for early Alzheimer's. He actually said they were discovering all these microbes in the brain, which we thought was sterile, and that we had this blood-brain barrier that protects us.
Right.
And you're saying, and he's saying, that that barrier is not always 100%. And that stuff can leak through. Not only can you have a leaky gut, but you can have a leaky brain.
Look, bacteria, not to scare people, bacteria love the brain. Why? 25% of the body's glucose is used by the brain. They know where to eat. They're going to, Le Pen or the fancy restaurant is downtown. Like everyone else is eating downtown. They're getting, our brains.
But can bacteria live on ketones?
100%. Wait, that's very important. They prefer simple sugars. Why? Because they're lazy, right? They want instant gratification. So they like sugar better than ketones.
But ketones and ketotic diets work for some of these neurodegenerative diseases like Alzheimer's and even LS and brain cancer. That's right.
And I think one of the mechanisms, to be honest with you, is that ketones actually improve mitochondrial function, but they're not a good substrate for bacteria. They're a great substrate for us. Bacteria don't like them because they like eating fast food, basically.
Yeah. So feed them sugar, we eat fat.
That's right.
Okay. So this is just a breakthrough idea. And this isn't just an idea. You've actually treated patients using this approach and seen some really extraordinary things.
Yes.
So can you share with us, a little bit about this case you were sharing with me earlier about ALS, which is a horrible condition. Stephen Hawking had it. It was called Lou Gehrig's disease after the baseball player. Essentially, it's where your nervous system is affected by the killing of the neurons in your spinal cord, which makes you basically paralyzed. You get fasciculation, which is twitching. You eventually can't move your arms and legs. You're in a wheelchair. It's you a can't disease. Breathe. You need a respirator.
You wouldn't wash it on your worst enemy. You would not work.
It's like a slowly getting paralyzed, right?
Yep, that's right.
And never has there been a treatment that has stopped or reversed it.
Right.
And you're saying that you've seen patients where this has actually happened.
So, we are in the process of validating that data. Yes.
So yes, we need more studies. Yes, we need to do research on multiple patients.
Right.
But even if there's one patient
right.
where you've seen a change, it raises the question.
Oh, it's, by the way, it's made me go crazy, by the way, because, you know, I'm finally glad to be a neurologist. You know, being a neurologist is like being a nihilist or a masochist.
Diagnose and adios, right?
Well, it's worse than that. It's like diagnose and let me not tell the patient that they have ALS. Let me treat them for, you know, like a CIDP picture, because they don't want to actually make that diagnosis for people. It's the hardest diagnosis you could make for a mm-hmm. patient, because everyone knows ALS is incurable disease, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, it's 100%. It's like not even pancreatic cancer is better. Well, you have a 5% chance of living with pancreatic cancer. You have zero chance of living through this disease. Mm. Zero.
So based on your hypothesis that it's infectious,
yes.
that plays a big role, if not is the main role.
Right.
You know, I personally shared on this podcast that I went to a place in Mexico called Santa Viva, where I and my wife both went through this treatment called hyperthermia, which essentially is where they heat you up to 107 degrees, which sounds crazy and is scary.
Right.
But actually, we did both fine, and it killed a lot of infections that we had.
Yeah, like you mentioned, it's amazing.
Lyme,
right.
My wife, her viral loads of a very tough to treat infection
yep.
called CMV came plummeting down.
Yep.
She felt much better. I felt
amazing.
Much better. And it so this is a therapy that is not much used in the United States, but is used widely in Europe, is
Correct.
Used in Mexico and other
right.
countries as a
right.
therapy for some of these types of infectious diseases and even cancer.
Right.
So how does the theory work behind this with something like ALS?
Well, the idea is that, you know, fever is the way of actually denaturing spores. So
okay, that's a big sentence. Can you unpack that?
Sure. So human cells have their proteins that, you know, either fold properly or not fold properly at a certain temperature, mm-hmm. right? Bacteria have their own temperature zone, like their ideal climate, and spores have another ideal climate, right? Meaning that to kill a spore...
A spore is like a baby bacteria.
A spore is a baby bacteria. And that's what I believe personally is the reason that patients have amyloid accumulation, that the spores are creating this protective cover against antibiotics that actually is, in fact, the amyloid being produced.
So the amyloid is like the armor for the bacteria.
Yes, they're like the, you know, the bomb shelter.
Yeah.
The biofilm is the bomb shelter for these little baby bacteria. Yep.
And so how does hyperthermia work to disrupt that?
What is
that
because
procedure?
Hyperthermia works by, it's a very narrow window of temperature. Meaning if you give too much temperature, you can actually hurt normal cells as much as, you know, bacterial cells. If you don't give enough temperature, you've done nothing.
So it's like Goldilocks.
It's right? like Goldilocks.
You got it just right.
You have to get it exactly right, okay? And that's part of the way that the hyperthermia technology has been developed is by really understanding that the brain itself can provide feedback on the tolerability for human cells, because brain cells are gonna tell the brain, hey, this is pretty hot in here.
You don't want to fry your brain.
Right. Can you turn the thermostat off now? So the part of the device actually is to get the brain temperature back into the feedback system where it's self-regulating, so that you never reach a point where the temperature is harmful to your own cells.
Mm. And so, you know, they often in places where they do this, they'll give at the peak of the temperature, they'll give antibiotics or antivirals.
Right.
Does that make sense?
To give antivirals?
Or, yeah, to give antimicrobial treatment to patients when they're at the peak of the fever, because the idea is that it sort of flushes out the...
Oh, I see. For acute infection, yes. I would argue
like
that...
Like Lyme or...
Well, if the Lyme is acute, certainly. I mean, I don't think that I mean, I think you got to be weary of the issue that by, you know, robbing Peter to pay Paul, for instance. Let's say that C. diff is... Let's say this is a polymicrobial disease, okay? As opposed to a...
Like lots of different bugs.
Lots of different bugs. As opposed to just one ringleader that everyone else is following, okay?
Mm.
So Lombard believes that C. diff is the ringleader, okay? And all these other guys, Lyme, HSV, they're tagging a ride because it's such a great killer that it's like, okay, great, we'll take the leftovers, no problem here. we'll take the leftovers. So my concern is clinically that if we start treating patients, you know, with, you know, bacterial drugs like Rocephin, whatever it is for chronic Lyme, yes, you're addressing chronic Lyme.
I mean, the C. diff gets worse.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly.
So the heat alone is enough to disrupt the C. diff?
It's, well, we haven't demonstrated that yet, to be quite frank, but what's been demonstrated is that by applying hyperthermia, that we're able to actually see improvement in clinical symptoms of patients with ALS.
So people's muscle strength, this is a progressive disease, so it gets worse and worse and worse. Every visit, they're worse.
Right.
You're seeing patients that it stops or gets better, which never happened.
Correct.
Right. So this is a major breakthrough.
I think so.
Major breakthrough. And this is not something new. This has been around for a long time. So where in the world is most of the research being done on hyperthermia?
For ALS?
Period. I mean, it's
most of the research on hyperthermia actually is cancer research. So they call it chemohyperthermia. So people can look up a lot of data on how hyperthermia affects cancer. But as far as I know, there's zero data until now applying hyperthermia for ALS. We will be the first people to actually talk about applying hyperthermia for treatment of ALS.
What about things like Alzheimer's or Parkinson's or MS?
Well, the difference in those diseases are that in Alzheimer's, right, it's very difficult to induce hyperthermia in a patient with Alzheimer's disease. Why? Because you need to be compliant. The treatment itself is, you know, it's fairly rigorous, as you know from your
experience. They put me to sleep.
They put you to sleep, right? We don't want to put them to sleep, though, right? Because we're concerned about protecting their brain. So, you know, if you have a patient who's got, you know, end-stage Alzheimer's disease, for instance, I don't see how this is going to be helpful for them.
But
early, 100%.
Early.
Early. In fact, I will talk later, not about the case now, because we're really just in the beginnings of this case. But yeah, I think it would be applicable for Alzheimer's disease as well.
Have you seen any patients reported or in the literature
definitely not.
Or anywhere?
No.
But you sort of, it's a theory.
Yes, it's still a theory.
And MS? What about MS?
MS, there's data on actually the opposite, right? Which is, how do you induce hypothermia, right? Because in MS, it's an inflammatory disease, obviously, right? Which, by the way, I also believe is caused by Clostridium, but not C. diff, mm-hmm. where it's especially important to actually identify at that stage that this is bacterial. So there, I don't know what they're...
So what is the idea with MS? That you wouldn't want to use hyperthermia? That you wouldn't want to use heat because it makes it worse?
Well, because remember, when you heat up a patient with MS, what happens? They usually get worse. So the trick is...
But maybe not enough, right? Maybe it's not enough.
That's right. Maybe you haven't reached the threshold to actually, you know, use the body's fever mechanisms against...
Because there's links to MS and Epstein-Barr virus and other infections. There's links to Alzheimer's and herpes virus infections.
Right. So yes, the whole principle is applicable for all those diseases. But we don't know yet if it is applicable yet until we clinically demonstrate that, right? Yeah, I think that this is going to be a treatment that's going to be very important for a lot of different diseases, Mark.
So there's this whole theory that the body has a mechanism for dealing with this, and it has these own proteins that are produced in response to heat. And there are things we learned about in medical school. They're called heat shock proteins.
And I learned something very important about heat shock proteins from Dr. Lessler, because remember that, you know, people looking at how to induce hyperthermia, right? So there's all sorts of research. There's actually even a drug in clinic for ALS that is the mechanism of action is based upon increasing heat shock protein through a pharmaceutical agent. So I was at this lecture, and I thought I knew everything, basically, and I learned that actually you can induce.
Because you thought MD stood for medical deity, is that it?
Medical deity. Yes, exactly.
We all got that training.
Yeah.
The truth is, we know close to nothing.
That's why I said at the beginning of this talk. Thanks for inviting me, but I really know nothing. Just disclaimer. But anyway, so yes, actually in MS, the goal is to induce heat shock protein through hypothermia. Mm. Hypothermia.
So you get people cold.
Not people. The brain.
The brain.
Right. How do we do that?
Chill the brain.
Chill the brain.
How do you do that?
Yeah.
Ice blocks around the head?
No. No. Well, I'll invite you up and you could see for yourself what that looks like.
All right. Dunk your head in ice water.
Nope. 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 None of the above.
Okay. So we have to be in mystery here?
A mystery about what the device looks like, you mean?
Yeah.
It's basically the same concept as building a hyperthermia device, except remember now that technology itself was developed basically for anesthesiologists. Mm. So this was developed at Yale by Dr. Abreu, who's the person who actually discovered a way of measuring brain temperature objectively, externally. Okay, so that's kind of where this whole thing started from, to be honest with you. And
you don't have to stick an electrode in your brain. You can literally map it out from the outside.
You can map it out from the outside. So the ability to do that now allows a clinician to not only, you know, heat the body to create hyperthermic states, but through other types of modalities to actually cool the brain safely externally with the same way, meaning that you can actually apply a small device to a region of the skin, it's periorbital location, and you can actually change the temperature of the brain through this what's called the brain thermal tunnel,
and that also creates heat shock protein 70.
And I didn't know that until I was in Australia.
That's amazing. So you're hopeful about the future of neurology, it sounds like.
It's the first time I've been hopeful about anything in my life, to be honest with you.
I hope you enjoyed today's episode. One of the best ways you can support this podcast is by leaving us a rating and review below. Until next time, thanks for tuning in.
Hey, everybody, it's Dr. Hyman. Thanks for tuning into The Doctor's Pharmacy. I hope you're loving this podcast. It's one of my favorite things to do and introducing you all the experts that I know and I love and that I've learned so much from. And I want to tell you about something else I'm doing, which is called Mark's Picks. It's my weekly newsletter. And in it, I share my favorite stuff, from foods to supplements to gadgets to tools to enhance your health. It's all the cool stuff that I use and that my team uses to optimize and enhance our health. And I'd love you to sign up for the weekly newsletter. I'll only send it to you once a week on Fridays. Nothing else, I promise. And all you have to do is go to drhyman.com/picks to sign up. That's drhyman.com/picks, P-I-C-K-S, and sign up for the newsletter. And I'll share with you my favorite stuff that I use to enhance my health and get healthier and better and live younger longer.
Just a reminder that this podcast is for educational purposes only. This podcast is not a substitute for professional care by a doctor or other qualified medical professional. This podcast is provided on the understanding that it does not constitute medical or other professional advice or services. If you're looking for help in your journey, seek out a qualified medical practitioner. If you're looking for a functional medicine practitioner, you can visit ifm.org and search their Find a Practitioner database. It's important that you have someone in your corner who's trained, who's a licensed healthcare practitioner, and can help you make changes, especially when it comes to your health.